When the impulse to exterminate reemerged in Europe under the Nazis, very few people were able to recognize it as a homecoming, mistaking it instead for something wholly new, a kind of alien invasion. Now, this was not some kind of oversight. The failure to recognize these glaring continuities was a choice made by the powerful to protect their own interests. Because to place the Nazi Holocaust inside a lineage of Holocausts would have forced a reckoning with history.
That's Naomi Klein, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Naomi Klein on Holocausts and Historical Reckoning. Holocaust, derived from the Greek, is a large-scale calamity involving fire. Today, the term is specifically used to describe the German genocide of the Jews. But it has a long history. The European mass murder of indigenous peoples in North and South America killed 55 million, or 90% of the population, between 1492 and 1600. That's a little more than 100 years. More bloodbaths were to follow. In Africa, many millions were killed in the Congo by Belgium. Germany wiped out the Herero and Nama peoples in southwest Africa. In the Middle East, that was quickly followed by the Turkish slaughter of the Armenians. Then came Auschwitz. Since the end of World War II, barbarisms continue. Cambodia, Bosnia, Myanmar. Naomi Klein says, "The Nazi Holocaust is finally being placed in history, connected to the terrors that came before and after." Our guest today is Naomi Klein. She teaches at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Her articles appear in leading publications around the world. She's the award-winning author of many books. Her latest is Doppelganger. She spoke at Swarthmore College in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, in mid-April 2024. And now, Naomi Klein, Holocaust and Historical Reckoning.
Many colleges and universities have not shown the level of courage that you have here at Swarthmore. I've lost track of how many events have been canceled, how many student groups have been banned, how many protests have been repressed, how many chants have been twisted to mean their opposite. These bans, these unsayables, this is part of what we might think of as the word front of the war. And though it does not bear comparison with the sniper and cluster bomb front of the war, it has nonetheless been ferocious. Every time we speak on these topics, we feel the charge. And the words that tend to feel most combustible are reliably the ones that draw parallels between Israel's actions and the actions of the Nazis during the Second World War. Words like ghetto, concentration camp, liquidation, fascism, ethnic cleansing, even the word genocide itself. When we speak these words, we know we have to watch out. This war over words began very early. As soon as Israeli politicians responded to Hamas's horrific attacks on October 7th, by openly stating that they held 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza responsible, pledging to cut off food and water and rain down indiscriminate hellfire and treat Palestinians as, quote, human animals. And they followed through on many of these threats in myriad concrete ways with the full and enthusiastic backing of governments across the so-called West. In mid-October, Gustavo Petro, president of Colombia, identified this as a prelude to genocide, and he put out a statement that placed Israel's attacks in the context of a global war waged by the rich against the poor, one intensifying in the era of climate breakdown, when migrants are left to die on our increasingly fortress borders. He said, the barbarism of consumption based on the death of others leads us to an unprecedented rise of fascism, and thus to the death of democracy and freedom. It is barbarism, or global 1933, as I call it. 1933 was the year when Hitler rose to power. What we see in Palestine will also be the suffering of the world, of all peoples of the global South. This, of course, did not go over well, and Petro was condemned by Israel and its Western backers as an anti-Semite, predictably. But that did not prevent other leaders in the global South from saying much the same. In February, Brazil's president, Lula da Silva, who has long had friendly relationships with Israel, had become so alarmed with Israel's seemingly deliberate slaughter and starvation of the trapped Palestinian population in Gaza that he compared it with the Nazi genocide, saying he could think of no other analogy. Most contentious are the actions of the South African government and its decision to charge Israel at the ICJ in The Hague with violating the UN Genocide Convention. What I want to discuss is the reaction and where it fits into this larger war over words. Every time Israel has faced accusations that its actions in Gaza fit the legal definition of genocide or imminent genocide, the response has fit a very clear pattern. We are told that the accusations are inherently anti-Semitic, indeed blood libel against the Jewish people, who cannot possibly be committing genocide because A, Israel defines itself as a state of the Jewish people and was forged out of the flames of the Nazi Holocaust. Ergo, according to this logic, to compare Israelis to Nazis is to blame the victims for attempting to survive. And B, the Jewish state is under perennial threat of another Nazi genocide, as October 7th allegedly proved. Because Hamas are the real genocidal Nazis, not Israelis, according to this story, so anything Israel does is necessarily genocide prevention, not genocide perpetration. We've all heard variations of these circular arguments. They play out on a kind of repetitive loop. I want to zoom in on one example of this. When Lula made his comparison between Gaza and the Nazi Holocaust, Israel responded with a very unconventional piece of diplomatic theater. In addition to declaring Lula persona non grata, Israel's foreign minister summoned Brazil's ambassador for a reprimand. But he chose a very peculiar location for this diplomatic meeting, the Yad Vashem Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem. A people who suffered a genocide cannot possibly commit one, according to this logic, especially not a state that exists to prevent another Jewish genocide, which inside Israel's national narrative is always just over the horizon. Now, this episode is telling because it displays a complete collapsing of time and space. Israel's actions in Gaza are cast as a response to events that took place 8 decades earlier on another continent. The realities of past genocide atrocities are presented as definitive proof that it is heretical to compare any other crime to then, unless it's another crime committed against Israel, in which case those crimes can be presented as a seamless continuation of the Nazi Holocaust, never mind the difference in centuries, geographies, and the relative power of the players involved. Now, there have been many such clashes over language and historical analogies. Michael Rothberg, a chair of Holocaust studies at UCLA, refers to these skirmishes as comparison controversies. Another notable one was sparked by Masha Gessen. Writing in The New Yorker, Gessen compared Gaza pre-September 7th to a ghetto similar to the ghettos the Nazis used in Eastern Europe to warehouse and incarcerate Jews. And now, Gessen wrote of Gaza, quote, "The ghetto is being liquidated." Predictably, those words provoked apoplectic responses, particularly in Germany, where Gessen was very nearly stripped of the annual Hannah Arendt Prize for Political Thought, a particular irony given Arendt's commitment to deciphering the origins and foreshadowings of totalitarianism, including fascist totalitarianism. And I think open letters are probably still flying over Jonathan Glazer's speech at the Oscars, during which he dared to warn against the Nazi Holocaust being used as cover for crimes against humanity in Gaza. Now, to be clear, none of the people who I have cited were saying that Israel's crimes in Gaza are a carbon copy of the Nazi Holocaust, the most murderous chapter of the 20th century. Of course, they were not saying that. As Gessen stressed, to compare is not to conflate, not to erase specificity. Gaza is not a factory deliberately designed for mass murder, as the Nazi death camps were. And thankfully, we are not yet close to the scale of the Nazi death toll. But as we've already heard, multiple UN and US human rights experts tell us that millions of Palestinians face starvation now. Moreover, the entire reason that the post-World War II edifice of international humanitarian law was erected, including the ICJ and the Genocide Convention, was so that we would have the tools to collectively identify patterns before history repeats at scale. And some of the patterns, the walls, the ghettos, the mass killing, the repeatedly stated eliminationist intent, the mass starvation, the pillaging, the joyful dehumanization, and the deliberate humiliation are indeed repeating. I agree that we should never make Nazi analogies casually because it risks trivialization, but neither should we be so timid or so proprietary that we turn real-world political tendencies into mystical ones. Now, I wanted to begin with these various comparison controversies because they point to something foundational. Despite appearances, they are not simply battles over hot-button words and languages. They speak to a much deeper battle over what I've come to think of as two competing stories about the birth of the modern world. Two very different sets of ideas about what European fascism and the Nazis represented within these two stories. Were the Nazis an exception in an otherwise uplifting story of spreading progress and civilization to all corners of the globe? Or were their tactics and logics omnipresent in this story, a through line that has been the flip side of the civilizing project from the very start? Beneath these bitter disagreements about who deserves to be seen as a fascist and a Nazi in the here and now are far less explored disagreements about who the Nazis were originally when they came to power in the 1930s. So for simplicity's sake, let's call these two stories Story 1 and Story 2. Now, Story 1 doesn't require much explanation since it is the air we all breathe. It tells us that in the 1930s and 40s, large parts of liberal, democratic, peaceable Europe fell to the twisted and evil force that was fascism. In this story, the Nazis are the mirror opposite of everything for which Western powers stand, uniform to our pluralist, closed to our open, authoritarian to our democratic, cruel to our kind, and so on. In this story, Nazism emerged in Germany out of a unique and explosive combination of factors. The humiliation of the national psyche after Germany's defeat in World War I was compounded by the economic hardships unleashed by the Great Depression, and the two of these forces combined to unleash the hounds of anti-Semitism, according to Story 1, said to be a deep and primordial hatred that exists as an immovable subconscious in all cultures. So according to Story 1, this convergence of forces creates a kind of a rupture in the time-space continuum that was the Holocaust, a specifically anti-Semitic form of mass slaughter that has never been seen before, but which, now that it has been unleashed, could recur at any time, not to anyone, according to this story, but specifically to the Jews. The quote you see is from Sweden's former Prime Minister, Göran Persson, who was also the founder of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, the IHRA, which many of you may be familiar with from the IHRA definition that defines anti-Semitism as criticizing Israel as a Jewish state. So I use this quote because I think it might be the best capsule summary of what I'm calling story one, aka the story that the West likes to tell itself about the Holocaust. He said, "It happened once, it should not have happened, but it did. It must not happen again, but it could." That is why education about the Holocaust is fundamental. So he said that in 2000. Now, because it could always happen again, the unique and incomprehensible force that is anti-Semitism must be battled with its own special weapons, according to this narrative. And the most important of these weapons is not international law. No. Within story one, these are deemed to be too weak. There is only one force that can repel another Jewish genocide, and that is the highly militarized ethnostate of Israel, a fortress land for the Jews with its own army, bankrolled by Germany as a form of reparations for the Holocaust, but also by countries like the US and Canada, which, though they defeated Hitler on the battlefield, did close their borders to the vast majority of Europe's Jews who might have found asylum and been saved. So it's seen as a kind of reparation for governments here in North America, and also, of course, for Germany, which has defined standing with Israel as its Staatsraison, its reason for state. In story one, Israel is the embodiment of never again. So, of course, people who subscribe to it cannot fathom the possibility that Israel is perpetrating an again against another hated people right now. And, of course, story one is very convenient because all of these countries, US, Canada, Germany, the UK, have their own geopolitical and economic reasons for wanting a Western outpost in the middle of the oil and gas-rich Arab world, and how convenient it is to wrap that in the virtue of learning from the sins of the past. So this is a very familiar story to most of us who have received a classic Western education. The Holocaust was not the only crime against humanity that most of us learned about in school, of course. We also, no doubt, heard about the conquistadors, the mass slaughters of indigenous people. We learned about the trade in enslaved African people and Jim Crow and apartheid in South Africa. But these lessons, I assume, if your education was anything like mine, they were cordoned off from the ways we learned about the Holocaust, which was always in a class of its own, surrounded by a kind of ring of fire, to use a term from Claude Lanzmann, the filmmaker who made the landmark docuseries Shoah, which shaped understandings of the mass killings for generations. Lanzmann said this unique ring of fire was a boundary that you cannot cross because it is impossible to convey a certain absolute horror. Claiming to do so is to be guilty of the gravest transgression. So this is a very important principle to understand about how the Holocaust is imagined. You're not allowed to compare. So we absorbed the lesson that there was something sacrilegious about even speaking about the Nazi Holocaust in the same breath as any other crime, that to do so was to make it less horrific, somehow ordinary or trivial. This was the flip side of the post-World War II cries of never again, an unspoken never before. The Holocaust was a rupture in history, out of space and out of time. As Person said, it happened once. But what if it happened more than once? What if it happened many times, albeit at different speeds and scales? What if Holocausts are a through line? Which brings us to story two. So there has always been another way of understanding the Nazis' exterminatory project, another explanation, which was left out of the dominant histories that I've been invoking. It's a story that has always been told in the global South, in places with firsthand experience with European imperialism, and also in what's sometimes referred to as the South and the North, in Black and Indigenous communities in places like North America. In story two, the Holocaust was not a rupture, nor a new invention. Rather, it was a homecoming of the violent, exterminatory logics and methods that European powers had directed at those deemed savage and devilish since the Spanish Inquisition. Logics that began in Europe but for the past 500 years or so, mostly ravaged lands and bodies outside of Europe's borders, in the colonies. But according to story two, in the 1930s, those logics and methods turned inwards and were unleashed on large segments of the European population, with the subhumans being exterminated no longer Africans or indigenous peoples in the Americas, or not only, but white Europeans, albeit gay, disabled, autistic, Roma, communist, and on an unfathomable scale, Jewish Europeans. Story two does not see Hitler and the Nazis as an aberrant chapter in Western history, one that primarily has to do with the supposedly primordial nature of Jew hatred, though anti-Semitism certainly has deep roots in Europe. Rather, it sees the Nazis as an expression of an exterminatory supremacist logic that has been at the center of the most violent chapters in European history. One of the most important voices in this early debate was W.E.B. Du Bois in The World in Africa, published at the close of the Second World War. He observed that, quote, there was no Nazi atrocity, concentration camps, wholesale maiming and murder, defilement of women, or ghastly blasphemy of childhood, which Christian civilization of Europe had not long been practicing against colored folk in all parts of the world in the name of and for the defense of a superior race born to rule the world. What was new, Du Bois wrote, was that genocide was coming home. This perspective was echoed by the Martinican anti-colonial author and politician Aimé César. In his hugely influential text, Discourse on Colonialism, first published in 1950, he rejected the flattering narrative that Nazism was somehow an alien force that had invaded civilized Europe, one that was valiantly slain by the British and the Americans while being resisted by the French, because they understood the dire threat that fascism posed to humanism. On the contrary, he wrote, Europeans tolerated Nazism before it was inflicted on them. Until these methods returned to European soil, he wrote, they absolved it, shut their eyes to it, legitimized it, because until then, it had been applied only to non-European peoples. Hitler's crime for the Allies, César believed, was that he did to Jews and Slavs what, quote, until then had been reserved exclusively for the non-white colonized in foreign lands. But seen from his perch in the Caribbean, where indigenous peoples had been slaughtered to make way for enslaved Africans, who Europeans forced into brutal labor, it was all one long, continuous, snaking story. Genocide after genocide. So I'll share one more quote because it is so striking. César, who taught and mentored Frantz Fanon, wrote that in his view, Hitler was not merely the enemy of the United States and the United Kingdom. He was their shadow, the part of themselves they could not bear to see, their twisted doppelganger. As Robin Kelly points out in an introduction to the reissue of César's book, many radical Black intellectuals, including C.L.R. James and George Padmore, quote, understood fascism not as some aberration from the march of progress, an unexpected right-wing turn, but a logical development of Western civilization itself. These thinkers, Kelly wrote, viewed fascism as a blood relative of slavery and imperialism, global systems rooted not only in capitalist political economy, but racist ideologies that were already in place at the dawn of modernity. So there is another source that we should turn to for what the Nazis learned from colonialism, and that is the Nazis themselves. Hitler spoke and wrote extensively about the many ways in which he modeled his genocidal regime after various European colonialist rampages, and from the structures of racial hierarchy pioneered inside North America, including on the Western frontier. So I'm going to give a few examples. In 1941, Hitler remarked, concentration camps were not invented in Germany. It is the English who are their inventors, using this institution to gradually break the backs of other nations. Concentration camps had, in fact, been used in many colonial contexts, by the Spanish in Cuba, by the British in what is now South Africa during the Anglo-Boer War, with tens of thousands of captives dying in the disease-ridden enclosures. And they were also used by the Germans before the Nazis came to power in Germany's African colonies, just 25 years before the Nazis rose to power. In fact, the event widely understood as the first genocide of the 20th century took place in what is now Namibia, with the mass slaughter of the Nama and Herero or Over Herero people. Germany had decided it needed room to grow, Lebensraum. We often think that this term came from the Nazi Holocaust, but it actually came from Africa. The colonists had set up various farms and settlements in Southwest Africa. They'd also heard there were diamonds, and they were interested in those. And they pushed the Nama and Herero people off of their lands and into the deserts. And eventually, the situation grew so desperate that the Herero rebelled, waged a war, which included killing many German settlers. The Germans responded with a genocidal fury. Those who survived the bullets were corralled into newly built concentration camps and forced into labor. The most deadly of these camps was in a place called Shark Island. By the time the camps were closed in 1908, 80% of the Herero had been exterminated, and roughly 50% of the Nama people. On Shark Island, each prisoner was carefully assigned a number, which was a prototype for the careful accounting in Nazi camps. And there were other lines of connection. Doctors and other scientists from Germany traveled to the camps to conduct medical experiments on the Nama and Herero, mostly involving measuring their skulls. They were, in fact, obsessed with skulls and sent hundreds of them back to be studied and displayed in German educational and cultural institutions. So with these measurements, the Germans were trying to prove, of course, that African skulls were smaller, which they were not. But it was an early example of the kind of bogus race science that formed the basis of the Nazi obsession with Aryan superiority. Less than three decades later, Jewish skulls and other body parts would also be measured in these same ways to prove their supposed inferiority. The lines of connection between these two chapters in the bloody history of eugenics were direct. For instance, one of the most active experimenters and skull collectors in Southwest Africa was Dr. Eugene Fischer. His research focused on the supposed perils of race mixing for the colonists. Hitler read his research while in prison and cited it in Mein Kampf. Once the Nazis came to power, Fischer adopted his racial purity theories to the supposed threat of Jewish blood. He also joined the Nazi Party. He trained several SS doctors, including the so-called Angel of Death, Joseph Mengele. Mengele was known for his gruesome experiments on twins in Auschwitz. As with the Nama and Herero, Jewish and Roma skulls and other parts were also preserved for German study. So this is not 6 degrees of separation between a genocide in Africa and a genocide in Europe. This is no degrees of separation. The Nazis also drew inspiration from further afield, including, as we've been learning more and more, from the bogus race science and racial apartheid that reigned in this country at the time that the Nazis were formulating their ideology. For their war on the disabled, they took inspiration from the U.S. eugenics movement, including state laws that mandated forced sterilization of those deemed of inferior genetic stock. This was the era of Jim Crow segregation laws, and Hitler got more pointers on how to strip German Jews of their citizenship by studying these laws. So much of this has been known in the academy, but it has started to reach mass audiences in recent years through books like James Whitman's Hitler's America Model, The United States and the Making of Nazi Race Law, which came out in 2017. And this was further popularized in 2022 with Ken Burns's docuseries, The U.S. and the Holocaust, as well as Raoul Peck's series for HBO, Exterminate All the Brutes. This literature also explores the way the Nazis were shaped and influenced by the Western frontier in this country. The core precept of settler colonialism that saw colonists push ever westward to claim more territory for settlement, deploying a range of genocidal tactics to eliminate indigenous people from their lands. In the early 1900s, It had been the African colonies that played this settler colonial role for Germany. But when Germany lost those colonies in the First World War, they needed their Lebensraum, and so they came up with this idea that they could model an eastward expansion, expanding into Poland and Russia. But it was explicitly modeled after the Western frontier, and Hitler was constantly making comparisons when he talked about Slavs or Jews to how the Americans had gunned down the Indians, which he was very impressed by. I'll share a few of his charming quotes. He said, "There is only one task, to set about the Germanization of the land by bringing in Germans and to regard the indigenous inhabitants as Indians." So it's pretty straightforward. Hitler said this in 1941. This was a direct parroting, of course, of the discourse of settler colonialism now brought back home to Europe.
You're listening to Naomi Klein, Holocaust and Historical Reckoning. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
On the right to lay claim to Ukraine's grain, Hitler once joked, "We'll supply the Ukrainians with scarves, glass beads, and everything that colonial people like." I hope this makes clear that the Holocaust was not, as story one would have it, an event out of time, out of history. It was very much of its time and very inside the history of the 20th century. I just want to do a quick show of hands and ask you, how many of you learned any of this in school? Like, how many of you, when you had your Holocaust studies, learned that Hitler had studied the Western frontier, that he had studied Jim Crow laws? Did anybody learn this at school? All right, so we've got like six people about in a room of hundreds. And you seem to be younger people, if I may observe. I certainly did not learn about it in my Jewish day school in Montreal in the 1970s. I barely learned about the Indigenous genocide. Now, in Canada, that is changing and improving. My son, who's 11, learns about, for instance, the cruel residential school system where Indigenous children were basically kidnapped from their homes and taken against their will to, as one Canadian official said, kill the Indian in the child. And so, you know, the students today learn about the unmarked graves where thousands of Indigenous children are buried on the grounds of these monstrous institutions. And they read books about how Indigenous children had to cut off their braids and were prevented from speaking their languages and practicing their ceremonies. But this knowledge is not connected, at least in the official curriculum, with what they are taught about the Holocaust or the longer arc of Jewish people being persecuted for practicing their religion and culture. Even in universities, Holocaust studies are largely cordoned off from genocide studies, from studies of enslavement and apartheid and racial capitalism and the study of settler colonialism. And I think this is part of why, since October 7th, so many of us have been talking past each other. We actually don't have a lot of experience talking to each other. These literatures are extremely siloed, and we are not familiar with each other's bodies of knowledge, I think scandalously so, and this is really revealing the cracks in this moment because we need to understand each other. We can't just have separate versions of how the world was born. This process of compartmentalization and not seeing the parallels is, of course, a great way to short-circuit possible solidarities, break apart coalitions before they begin. And it also points to the uncomfortable fact that white supremacist assumptions are even embedded in the wildly different and disparate ways that we remember and commemorate genocides. Germany, which prides itself on its memory culture and its willingness to make amends for the bloodiest parts of its past, waited until 2021, just 3 years ago, before recognizing the Nama and Herero genocide. And it still refuses to use the word reparations or compensation, unlike the Jewish genocide, which, as discussed, is Germany's Staatsräson, or making amends for it, which it equates with standing with Israel. In Germany's capital cities, there are no memorials to the Nama and Herero genocide, no museums either. One detail that I find really striking and kind of shattering is that the only museum devoted to documenting the genocide of the Nama and Herero is in Squamand, Namibia. So I've tried to give you the barest of glimpses at story two. I can't cover it. It's the history of the world. A long story of annihilating the other in the name of progress, civilization, and God's will. It doesn't actually begin in Europe's colonies, but inside Europe, in the Spanish Inquisition and the bloody expulsion of Jews and Muslims. As many historians have noted, it's striking that 1492, the year that Jews were officially expelled from Spain, is the same year that Christopher Columbus's ships set sail on their voyage of so-called discovery. Those ships unleashed centuries of this same logic, deploying that supposed God-given superiority to rid the land of infidels, now played out on vastly larger scales. But because these more sinister parts of the civilizing project were never reckoned with, never mind repaired, when the impulse to exterminate reemerged in Europe under the Nazis, very few people were able to recognize it as a homecoming, mistaking it instead for something wholly new, a kind of alien invasion. Now, this was not some kind of oversight. The failure to recognize these glaring continuities was a choice made by the powerful to protect their own interests, because to place the Nazi Holocaust inside a lineage of Holocausts would have forced a reckoning with history. It would have radically changed how we understand our national origins, how we make sense of the stark inequalities that scar our own societies and our world. It would have been revolutionary. So that story could not carry the day. Far more convenient to paint the Nazis as uniquely monstrous and arrogant and aberrant, and the Jewish people as hated in ways that cannot be compared to any other group. The dominance of this historical story has come at an extremely high cost. Because it fundamentally misconstrued who the Nazis were, forbade comparison, treated them like they emerged from outer space, barred the tracing of origins and genealogies, we cannot recognize the patterns, or many of us can't, when they recur. And of course, nowhere is the cost higher for these failures than in Palestine today. Many of Zionism's basic rationales were thinly veiled Judaizations of core Christian colonial concepts. Terra nullius became a land without a people for a people without a land. Manifest destiny became land bequeathed to the Jews by divine right. Taming the wild frontier became making the desert bloom. Civilizing or Christianizing became Judaizing. There were notable differences in this doppelganger version of settler colonialism, however. Where European powers colonized from a position of strength and a claim to God-given superiority, the post-Holocaust Zionist claim to Palestine was based on the reverse, on Jewish victimization and vulnerability. The tacit argument many Zionists were making at the time was that Jews had earned the right to an exception from the decolonial consensus, an exception born of their very recent extermination. The Zionist version of justice said to Western powers, if you could establish your empires and your settler colonial nations through ethnic cleansing, massacres, and land theft, then it is discrimination to say that we cannot. If you cleared your land of its indigenous inhabitants, or did so in your colonies, then it is anti-Semitic to say that we cannot. It was as if the quest for equality was being reframed, not as the right to be free from discrimination, but as the right to discriminate. Colonialism reframed as reparations for genocide. Except if Hitler had been inspired by settler colonialism in Africa and North America, including colonial genocides, and he clearly was, then this was anything but reparations. It was replication, a continuation of the colonial logic, but with broken and traumatized people let loose on a people even less powerful than themselves. Palestinians under this arrangement became, as the anti-colonial scholar Edward Said put it, the victims of the victims, or in the words of Joseph Massad, the new Jews. This, I think, explains many of the battles over words we have been having these past 6 months. These are all proxy battles for the underlying battle over how we understand the making of the modern world, and where Israel and Palestine and even the climate crisis fit into that bloody story, hundreds of years long, a long arc of fascism. I'm going to wrap up here. I want to leave us, though, with a great prophetic voice, that of the Jewish-German philosopher Walter Benjamin. He wrote that there is no document of civilization which is not at the same time a document of barbarism. He was inspired by the painting Angelus Novus by his friend Paul Klee. Benjamin saw a universe in this figure, and he shared his vision in the 1940 essay, Theses on the Philosophy of History. The painting, Benjamin wrote, shows an angel looking as though he is about to move away from something he is fixedly contemplating. His eyes are staring, his mouth is open, his wings are spread. This is how one pictures the angel of history. His face is turned towards the past. Where we perceive a chain of events, he sees one single catastrophe which keeps piling wreckage upon wreckage and hurls it in front of his feet. The angel would like to stay, awaken the dead, and make whole what has been smashed. But the storm is blowing from paradise. This storm is what we call progress. Benjamin took his own life that same year in a seaside Catalan town, unable to escape the fascists. So this really is his last wish for us, that we stop seeing history as a chain of singular disconnected events and crises, but rather grasp the one single catastrophe which unceasingly piles rubble on top of rubble, a past that turns the future into a storm we call progress. So where are we now? 8.5 decades after he made that plea. Very deep in the wreckage. Huge parts of our world lie in rubble. No cleanup crew is on the way. And nothing about this is metaphorical. Not the rubble, not the piles of bodies, not even the storm that Benjamin invoked. In the name of progress, the underworld has been disinterred and deposited in the sky, unleashing the uncontrollable storms of the climate breakdown. It is why leaders like Colombia's Gustavo Petro fear that in Gaza they are seeing a glimpse of the future for the entire global south. But something is shifting. Benjamin's angel wanted to awaken the dead, but he could not, not then. But today, the dead are awakening. We see it in South Africa's case before the ICJ. It is about saving lives and stopping genocide in Gaza. And it has also become an occasion for that suppressed story about the birth of the modern world to finally be told on the world stage, a long-delayed rendezvous with history. When Germany announced that it was siding with Israel in the case, the government of Namibia stepped forward to say, if Germany has not yet atoned for its genocide in Namibia, the first genocide of the 20th century, perhaps it should stop positioning itself as an expert on how to prevent genocides in the present day. Nicaragua, meanwhile, has launched its own case at the ICJ accusing Germany of aiding genocide with its weapons shipments to Israel. And Nicaragua, of course, has its own bloody history of colonial massacres. The courtroom is always a classroom, but I don't recall a time when so many lessons have been taught simultaneously. It is as if by naming Israel's Gaza onslaught as a colonial genocide, in the lineage of previous colonial genocides, the mass graves that exist on every continent have flown open and the ghosts have begun to tell their tales, comparing notes. This is what Benjamin wanted for us, to see the connections between traumatic events, to identify the underlying supremacist logics at work, to recognize patterns, to remember history, put its shattered pieces back together, tell the long-suppressed alternate story. So of course this moment is wrenching, and of course we are fighting over words and chants. The Nazi Holocaust is finally being placed in history, connected to the terrors that came before and after. It is possible to get out of this endlessly recurring genocide loop. It is not too late to learn the lessons our predecessors failed to learn. Not too late to stop upping the ante with ever more powerful weapons and with stakes that are now planetary in scale. But it begins with telling the truth. Thank you.
I wanted to ask about the weaponization of anti-Semitism used to suppress pro-Palestine activism that we've seen across college campuses, including on our own, and how this weaponization is a part of that first story of the Holocaust that you mentioned.
What I got into in the talk was this collapsing of time that happens, right? Where you have this suturing together of the Holocaust with October 7th as if there's this one continuous event, one continuous Holocaust, as if eight centuries don't separate them. I think this relates to the previous question around why exceptionalism is so important to Zionism, why Jews must be exceptionally hated. There's always a conflict of interest, I think. If a state supposedly needs to exist in order to keep Jews safe, and you know, one of the most disgraceful things that has happened in this period has been the repeating of this line by Joe Biden and other US politicians that if Israel didn't exist, no Jew in the world would be safe, right? So this is the story. That is Israel's Staatsraison, right? And it is, right, to keep Jews safe from the primordial and ever-present threat of genocide. Then the last thing that you want is for Jews to be safe. Like, the last thing you want is to actually throw down in multiracial, multiethnic, anti-racist coalitions to try to get at the root of really, you know, and this is, I think, the importance of what I'm calling story two, is that it's about getting to the logics, right? It's not just looking at, like, extracting from the Holocaust a rule, which is, you know, anti-Semitism is wrong and we have to fight it whenever it rears its head, but understanding what this logic of creating an inside group and an outside group, one group putting itself higher than another group and using that as an excuse to pillage lands, you know, and resources, that has come pretty much always going to end in some kind of bloody mess and very likely genocide. So it isn't that exceptional. You know, I'm not saying that there isn't anti-Semitism on campus. I think there is a surge of many different forms of hatred right now, anti-Palestinian, Islamophobia, and anti-Semitism, and this always happens whenever there is a surge of Israeli violence. It's really hard for, I think, people to pry apart because you have a state that is acting in the name of Jews, right? It is saying it is a Jewish state. But we still have a responsibility to say, actually, you don't represent Jews, and to make very careful distinctions and fight anti-Semitism along with anti-Palestinian racism and Islamophobia and all other forms of hatreds in our movements here, well, mainly because it's the right thing to do and we should be guided by principles. If you're anti-Zionist, it's also a great way to drain Zionism of some of its power because its main argument is that Jew hatred is eternal and they always seize, I mean, it's why there's sort of this constant inflation of this idea that US campuses are incredibly unsafe for Jews and so on, that all feeds the Zionist story, right? As long as Jews are not safe in the diaspora, that's why you need a fortress ethnostate. So that is the way anti-Semitism has always been weaponized by Zionism. And I think we're in a moment where Israel, because it is committing mass war crimes in broad daylight, needs to you double down on that rationale for its own existence. So if we're seeing more weaponization of it, I think that's probably why. But we still need to be very vigilant about it. And just because it is weaponized doesn't mean we don't have to worry about it, if you know what I mean. I think that that's one of the dangers of having it distorted and weaponized, is that then we can just kind of shrug our shoulders and say it's not an issue. And nothing is a bigger gift to fascist forces who are all aligned with Zionists right now, whether it's Marine Le Pen or Giorgio Meloni or Viktor Orban. You know, it's a gift for them to be able to say, you see what's happening over here? That's why it's a special kind of hatred. It's particularly strong on the left. Ergo, this state must exist as a supremacist state.
You talked a lot about Holocaust exceptionalism, and in the world we're in, where this like hegemonic view of what anti-Semitism is what is codified and what is like structurally in power, how can we as like students on campus combat that? How do we create a viable alternative to this world? Especially like you mentioned going to Jewish day school, a lot of Jewish communities are bent towards this like Israel vision. A lot of Jewish communities have these definitions of anti-Semitism that are so deeply codified within them. How do we combat that hegemonic story when people are like so caught up in that?
I mean, honestly, I think you've been doing it, and I think that that is why campuses have been the sites of such extreme repression and investigation, and I think what deserves to be called a new McCarthyism, and I say that as the granddaughter of somebody who was blacklisted during the McCarthy years, and I think it's driven by a real fear that campuses are places, they're not the only places, but they're places where meaning is made, where people get their worldviews, and they also get their worldviews changed and challenged. And the polling on generational shifts among Jews is terrifying. Their elders and the legacy Jewish organizations who are watching as their kids join, JVP, and if not now, and ask very deep questions about whether or not they had got a Holocaust education or an indoctrination or, these rituals of re-traumatization. You mentioned the museums. One of the things that really strikes me and that I think is a really important part of trying to understand where we are is that a lot of what passed as Holocaust remembrance was actually re-traumatization. And the reason it was re-traumatization is because the Holocaust was being instrumentalized to turn us, I don't know about you, but me, into Zionists, right? It was a plot point in a larger story. Like, let's not let the weaponization drain away the horror of it. But then immediately it pivots to, therefore, Zionism. If you're stuck in a trauma loop, one of the ways you know you're stuck in it is that time collapses, right? So I was talking before about this sort of confusion of like, is it still 80 years ago? What was October 8th? Was it a Holocaust, or was it a very bloody, anti-colonial uprising? And the discourse was immediately to suture it onto the Holocaust and to call it the bloodiest day in Jewish history since the Holocaust and so on. So collapsing time and space. This is a symptom of trauma. This is why I say this is a miseducation. This is the opposite of leadership. Tries to keep people in a traumatized state, tries to reinscribe the trauma in future generations. It isn't a natural occurrence that people who never experienced that trauma firsthand would feel as if they do. That was inscribed. That's what's being called an education. It's not an education. It is re-traumatization, and it's instrumentalization, and has a very clear political goal. I think many young people are now understanding this. I think it is terrifying their elders, who sent them on their birthright trips and March of the Living trips, and it's starting to break down. And so you're asking, what do we do? That's why it is so important that you experience feelings of safety with one another. It's why it matters how you treat each other, It matters if people get a body knowledge of something else, whether that's friendships and relationships on campus, a revolutionary spirit, real solidarity, that actually matters. Yeah, that helps. Not to sound too maternal here, but you are up against very serious forces. You're up against a two-party system that is trying to crush this. You're going to be told that you're bringing back Donald Trump, all of it. And you really, all that you really have are one another in your movements, right? You're not going to get a pat on the head for any of this activism, right? The urgency to build cultures within movements that can sustain you so that people don't burn out and feel really unsafe within movements is incredibly important, because you know, your activism, even though you've experienced unbelievable pushback, it's nothing compared to what Palestinians are facing right now as we speak. So yeah, you're getting pushback, and it's that old story, pushing back. Of course it is. But you're telling the story now. You're telling it. So take care of each other and find solidarity and show that you don't need an ethnostate, and nobody gets an ethnostate, because you can keep each other safe. Thank you.
You were just listening to Naomi Klein, Holocaust and Historical Reckoning. She spoke at Swarthmore College in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, in mid-April 2024. Naomi Klein teaches at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. An award-winning author, her latest book is Doppelganger. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent, unembedded nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Vijay Prashad, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, Chris Hedges, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Naomi Klein, Holocaust and Historical Reckoning, and her book, Doppelganger, call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.